From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. The World Press convened this week in, of all out-of-the-way places, North Korea. The leadership of the ordinarily locked-down police state took the unusual step of inviting selected news agencies into the country, ostensibly to witness the launch of a weather satellite.
Well, the world watched, and North Korea failed.
A total dud. It was all over so quickly, George. That rocket was only airborne for 81 seconds.
A long-range missile launch, ending with the rocket splintering into pieces over the ocean.
Okay, so it didn't go so well. Quite the loss of face for the brand-spanking new supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, adding to the deep curiosity about recent events. Why take such a risk? Why flout an agreement for food aid in exchange for a missile test moratorium practically before the ink was dry? And perhaps most of all, why suddenly open the gates to the prying eyes of the international press? Earlier in the week, the U.S. government had expressed its concern that reporters might be playing into North Korea's hands. A spokesperson from the National Security Council told Politico that, quote, reporters have to be careful not to get co-opted. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know this is a propaganda exercise. Of course, as events unfolded, it became apparent that even rocket scientists are fallible. Speaking hours before Friday's launch, North Korea analyst B.R. Myers speculated that the point wasn't what the foreign media would see, but that they had converged on North Korea's capital to see it.
They are pawns, or they are being co-opted in the sense of being used as extras in North Korean propaganda broadcast. One of the big myths of the official culture is the notion that North Korea is at the center of the world's attention. And there's no better way to illustrate that than to have a bunch of foreign journalists jockeying for a better look at the missile. And I've already seen the North Korean TV broadcasts. They've already reported proudly on the presence of these foreign reporters. So in that sense, I think these correspondents are being exploited regardless of what they write for the folks back home. Having said that, though, I think North Korea always exploits the American press, not so much through correspondents as through op-ed contributors. North Korea has a strategy of inviting, say, the same 6 or 10 American academics or experts to the country, treating them to very exclusive conversations and meetings. Those travelers then go back to the States and then write a sympathetic op-ed piece. That's really where the danger lies.
Once all of this Western press is actually situated in the country, isn't there a risk that the picture that comes out of North Korea will not serve the regime's interests?
I would say it's more than a risk. It's almost a certainty. It is so ultranationalist and so wrapped up in itself that it really is not able to present itself to the outside world as skillfully as the Soviets were doing in the last decades of the USSR. I think the average report from Pyongyang by a correspondent who's been let in for the first time really dwells on the bizarreness and the kookiness of the place and on all the limitations under which he was placed while trying to do his job. But the North Koreans might well be thinking that the domestic propaganda benefits of having foreign journalists there in front of North Korean cameras would outweigh those risks.
This gets to the oddity of the situation. It's hard for me to understand how this totalitarian regime so craves the sense of legitimacy from its public that will take that risk just to show North Koreans how it is at the center of the world's attention. It doesn't strike me as being a particularly good bet.
I suppose what you're really asking is why don't they just put the country under lockdown and just rule the way they want to rule instead of trying to curry favor with the public? And I think the answer is that trying to rule by pure coercion requires a level of economic resources that the North Koreans simply don't have. They're not in the position, for example, to seal off their northern border to keep people from escaping. So the only way that they can remain in power is by inspiring the people. And the best way to inspire people is through displays of military strength.
So the conventional wisdom, of course, is that missile launches are used as bargaining chips with the United States and with China. But if you're right, it's more political theater aiming to guarantee the continuation of the regime.
It's basically foreign policy as an adjunct of domestic propaganda. They signed that agreement on February 29th, and mere weeks later, they announced that they were going to carry out this missile launch. That is not the behavior of a state that is primarily interested in securing aid deals from the outside world. If it were about money, obviously they would not be launching a missile, the cost of which would keep its people fed for almost a year.
Yeah, it's been estimated at about $500 million. This is not something that North Korea can shake out of the sofa cushions.
Exactly, and yet you still find Americans who think that they're launching the missile in order to get a better aid deal at the negotiating table. It's just absurd. I think that it stems from our refusal to consider the fact that North Korea has an ideology of its own. We Americans have always inclined to think that foreign countries simply react to our foreign policy, and I don't think that's the case this time.
Brian, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
B.R. Myers is a scholar and North Korea analyst. He spoke to us from Busan, South Korea. Meanwhile, on Thursday, the buses ferrying journalists from one organized event in Pyongyang to another took a wrong turn. Here's a quote from the report filed by the Associated Press's Tim Sullivan. A cloud of brown dust swirled down deeply potholed streets past concrete apartment buildings crumbling at the edges. Old people trudged along the sidewalk, some with handmade backpacks crafted from canvas bags. Two men in wheelchairs waited at a bus stop. There were stores with no lights and side roads so battered they were more dirt than pavement. "Perhaps this is an incorrect road," mumbled one of the North Korean minders. The press on the buses unsurprisingly went wild photographing this bedraggled tableau. For its part, the Associated Press hopes it will see much more of the hidden realities of North Korean society. In January, after a year of negotiations with North Korean leadership, the AP opened the first full-time, full-format Western Journalism Bureau in Pyongyang. Kathleen Carroll is the executive editor and senior vice president of the AP, and she says so far her staff in North Korea is only allowed to report freely within the capital. Anywhere else, they have to ask their host's permission.
We generally need to tell the agency that we're working with the kinds of places we want to visit, and we often have a
minder
person from the agency. Not a minder, because it's generally a journalist from the Korean Central News Agency. This is not an uncommon way to operate. I know a lot of people who don't do foreign coverage and haven't worked in difficult countries seem to have an idea that you land and wander about at will, and you know that's not true in a lot of places, not just North Korea. We have long had a bureau at the White House, for example, but we don't wander the halls at will there either.
Fair enough, but most likely those who you encounter there will bear no consequences for speaking to you. Will you be free to speak to ordinary North Koreans without fear that there will be repercussions for them?
We already do talk to North Koreans. The challenge there is more that there is no tradition of engaging journalists who ask the kinds of questions that we ask on the part of the people there. So I think the greater issue is to try and have a comfort level where people are actually talking with us about issues that are important to them, rather than feeling the need to say whatever they think is expected of them. You know, it's not something that people automatically know how to do, to talk to reporters, and particularly in a place where they have no access to the kind of journalism that we do.
Is it just a question of tradition, or is it fear of reprisal?
It's a fair question, but we don't think that the kind of journalism that we're doing right now is the kind that is going to get somebody thrown in a gulag for answering a question on the street about their reaction to some world event.
Sometimes when Western reporters are trying to work from the midst of hostile or repressive regimes, the reporting comes with a disclaimer. This story was either censored or produced under heavy restrictions from the government. Will your coverage require any kind of warning label such as that?
Absolutely not. We do not submit to censorship. We would not ever have agreed to anything like that. We are going to write things and take pictures of things and make videos of things both inside North Korea and outside North Korea that they might not necessarily like. it happens sometimes, and the argument is loud sometimes. We both know that there are going to be some healthy disagreements ahead of us. Obviously, if one of those disagreements led to AP being booted from the country, we would choose to be booted rather than to stay and be asked to compromise how we operate.
You're aware, of course, that the White House has warned not the AP in particular, but news organizations in general over this missile launch, not to get caught up in the North Korean propaganda machine. It seems to me that you face that problem every day. How do you, as an organization, keep from being an outlet for the North Koreans' propaganda purposes?
As opposed to taking my editorial direction from the White House? We don't do that. Obviously, the White House is making a political statement. It happens to be in the venue of journalism. It's much better to be there and be able to ask questions, whether or not you get all the answers that you might seek, than it is to not be there at all. It's a process. You go there, you cover it to your best ability, and you push to try and get greater access. You push for additional information. And before you know it, the world is smarter about the place that you're covering because you're able to be there.
What have you learned that makes you see beyond the caricature of the ultra-repressive retrograde regime?
The people of North Korea are just like anybody else anywhere in the world. They want respect. They want their children to grow up to be healthy. They want to enjoy a good meal at a restaurant. They want a good life for themselves. The outside world gets a better sense of the people of North Korea, whether or not we are able to provide that level of transparency about the government of North Korea will remain to be seen.
Kathleen, thank you.
My pleasure.
Kathleen Carroll is the executive editor and senior vice president of the Associated Press. Coming up, a pair of Davids fighting the Goliaths of bureaucracy and special interests. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, the Obama administration got smacked with a scandal. Reports surfaced that members of the General Services Administration, a federal agency tasked with, among other duties, minimizing government costs, wasted $822,000 on a conference in Las Vegas for 300 GSA workers. Among the expenses, a mentalist, a clown, $7,000 in sushi, and apparently to wash down the raw fish, lots and lots of course, margaritas. In a video that circulated online, drunk GSA employees clutch cocktails and mangle Frank Sinatra songs.
Region 8 is here to sing along. Without the Rocky Mountains, what would you be left with? Region 8 is here tonight.
Professor Brendan Nyhan teaches at Dartmouth College and studies political scandals. Before the GSA fiasco, he'd written that Obama had the longest streak of scandal-free coverage of any president he'd studied. But he thinks there will be plenty more to come. Brendan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
For the purposes of this conversation, what is the definition of a scandal?
The definition of scandal I use in my research is a controversy that's called a scandal in the Washington Post by the reporter themselves, so not quoting a source. And the story has to appear on the front page of the Post to ensure that it's a salient controversy. It's a matter that the Post editors have decided is of high importance.
That's interesting because the GSA scandal is, in terms of cost to the taxpayer, obviously quite trivial. Yes, $822,000 is a lot to spend on government employees conducting business, but it's less than a rounding error on the budget of the executive branch. So it's scandalous. Why?
Well, the argument that I've made is that the president is especially vulnerable to scandal when there aren't many competing news stories. And I think the day the GSA scandal broke happened to be a relatively slow news day. So it was in the period where Mitt Romney was assumed to be on his way to the Republican nomination, but Rick Santorum hadn't yet dropped out, and there weren't a lot of competing news stories. So this controversy ends up being the lead story in the Washington Post, not just A1, but top right. And that placement helped vault it into the national consciousness as a story when on other days, if there were other more interesting or important stories in the news, it might have been buried and forgotten.
If that's true, then Mitt Romney's ascension as the presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency will create a news vacuum in the absence of any Republican primary campaigning that will be filled by other stories that rise to the level of scandal, even if the stakes are not particularly high.
That's right. There are going to be a lot of bored political reporters between now and the conventions who have to fill space, and there's only so many content-free vice presidential nomination stories you can file. So eventually they're going to turn their attention to the Obama administration. One of the reasons that Obama has avoided scandal for so long, at least by the terms I use in my research, is the economy's been so bad that there's been very little incentive for Republicans to push scandal allegations. But as the economy's improved, that incentive has changed.
Okay, now I'm going to do you a great favor here. I'm going to save you from criticism that your research is entirely premised on the idea that presidential scandals are a function of external factors like the general news environment than they are about the intrinsic worth of the story. You're not saying, are you, that the intrinsic worth of the story is immaterial and that it's just what else is going on in the news that matters, are you?
Absolutely not, and I appreciate you clarifying that and protecting my reputation. I'm not saying that the content of a scandal doesn't matter. What I am saying is that on the margin, the political and media context in which an allegation is made can make the difference between a controversy fizzling and going onto the front page. So context matters. It's not the only factor.
So let's just assume for a moment that the president and nobody high in his administration has done anything that falls under the category of high crimes and misdemeanors for which, you know, the nation is going to be torn to pieces, but that there is more to come, per your prediction. Any guesses as to what sort of thing is to come?
Well, if I had to guess, I would say something in the executive branch, like we've seen with the GSA scandal. The executive branch is so huge that an enterprising reporter can probably find something if they look hard enough. And if they dig into the GAO reports or other investigations going on within the federal government of itself.
Or inspectors general or something like that.
That's right. The government is a huge target when the president is held responsible for everything it does. So that seems like the most likely place to start, but it's very hard to know. One of the things we've learned about scandals is they're hard to anticipate, right? Who could have predicted Dick Morris and the Toes incident or any of these other things that pop up along the way?
I see no need even to remind listeners what that was all about. I think we're just going to let that pass.
Yeah, that's what Google is for, I guess.
Google it. Brendan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Brendan Nyhan is an assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. Scandals and presidents of the United States and illicit rocket launches have no trouble getting the attention of the press and the public. Not every important story is so explosive, however, or titillating. Lurking inside the Beltway at all times are countless public interest advocates who devote years and sometimes entire careers with a single-minded purpose verging on obsession. Their efforts are emphatically untitillating, yet they can influence the society in ways far beyond the headlines of the moment. We'll speak with two such fixtures right now. One is Andrew Schwartzman, policy director of the Media Access Project. For almost 40 years, MAP has advocated on behalf of consumers in the areas of media diversity, freedom of expression, and universal communication access, often clashing with the big media conglomerates and the FCC. But now the funding well has run dry, and the nonprofit public interest group is calling it a day. Schwartzman, who has himself been slinging stones at Goliath for more than 30 years, says MAP has never been the sexiest cause in town.
MAP has always been a particularly hard sell because we've focused on inside the Beltway legal representation at a pretty high level. That doesn't mean that stuff isn't important, but it's been hard to fund.
Would it be fair to say that the big bogeyman for the Media Access Project over the years has been media consolidation by a handful of gigantic corporations who own so many of the broadcast properties, radio and TV, and at least until recently, newspapers as well?
Two times now, the FCC has tried to relax its broadcast ownership rules, and we've successfully taken them to court to preserve those rules.
It seems to me that in some respects, you and others in the public interest world actually failed in fighting the consolidation of media into corporate ownership, but you've had some remarkable victories.
Well, certainly one of the things that we looked to was our work in creating low-power FM radio service. This is an important way to empower minority communities, empower small areas of interest, and an incubator to bring people into journalism, get them involved in the process of influencing public opinion.
And in interest of full disclosure, one of the media titans who actually was fighting against you in the battle for low-frequency FM?
Well, we had to fight the broadcasting industry, and that includes NPR, which gave us a very hard time. NPR was concerned about interference, and we have always thought that NPR should have embraced low-power FM as a kind of farm team system that would help create new talent rather than something to be feared.
Now, you haven't been around quite as long as the Washington Monument, but damn near, you started in the Carter administration. That's a lot of administrations ago. Were there any that were particularly sympathetic and particularly obstinate?
Well, I would certainly say that the Reagan years were the most difficult. The FCC chairman during the Reagan years, Mark Fowler, was an inveterate deregulator, and he was very good at what he did. He was a formidable foe. Frankly, even under Democratic administrations, the FCC has not always been sympathetic. It's very hard to be heard when you don't have the kind of resources that the big industries had. So it hasn't always been easy, even when there's been a more sympathetic FCC.
With all of the ebb and flow of regulation and of regulatory philosophy over the years, do you think that we're better regulated with respect to media in 2012 than we were when you got started back in 78?
One of the interesting things that's made this job so much fun is that it's technology-driven. And the challenge for the regulatory process under all kinds of administrations is coping with the change in technology. I think that taking into account all of those changes, the policymaking process is more responsive to the public than it was at that time. And the fact that there's a robust public interest community that has developed gives me optimism that things will continue to get better. You couldn't do this for 34 years if you were not an optimist. And I'm an optimist. We've made things a lot better.
Andy, once again, thank you very much and all best of luck.
Thank you, Bob.
Andrew Schwartzman is Senior Vice President and Policy Director for the soon-to-be former Media Access Project. You think media ownership is arcane? How about the issue of transparency in government safety standards? Dry as dust. Yet, an issue presenting a confounding and arguably un-American problem. That is, the sets of standards that the government uses to write laws are unavailable to the public unless the public pays money to see them. This is the bête noire of Carl Malamud, a government transparency advocate and president of public.resource.org. He believes safety standards should be easily accessible to all citizens for free. So Malamud's organization has ponied up the dough to purchase exactly 73 of these standards, which he will publish online, copyright or no copyright. Carl, welcome back to On the Media.
Well, thank you.
So there are regulations out there that are built on standards designed by the industry, and they are the law of the land, right?
Oh, absolutely. These are binding laws. They're laws of general applicability. That means that everybody in the United States has to obey them. They have criminal penalties, and they're critical to the public safety.
Well, give me a for instance.
The standard for portable fire extinguishers, the standard for drinking water system components and their health effects, the standard for testing for lead in water. These are not things you may necessarily want to read every day, but they certainly should be available to a small business person. They should be available to an engineering student, available to a journalist. For example, there's standards that say things like you shall not use lead paint on walls of schools. And what the law says is you shall not use lead paint. And we define lead paint in the following standard developed by, in this case, the American Society for Testing and Materials, known as ASTM. And those standards are pretty expensive. They're $50 to $100 for a couple pages. And so if you're a conscientious school principal, it's going to cost you hundreds or thousands of dollars simply to read these standards to see what they say.
Does that school principal have no other means of getting those standards than to pay the organization that has published them?
Most of these standards are simply not available in public libraries, so the only way you can get them is to spend the money or possibly go to Washington. There's one obscure office in the Office of the Federal Register that has one copy of every standard that's been incorporated by reference, and if you can make your way to that office, you might be able to read that standard.
Well, on the subject of the Federal Register, aren't the regulations published in full at the time they're adopted?
Regulations are published in full, but they don't publish the actual standard. They simply publish the fact that the standard has been incorporated, and then they put the address of the standards body that sells it. So if you want to read the full text of the law, you have to go to where these nonprofits are headquartered or go on the web and pay for these things. There's a principle in American law that the law doesn't belong to the government. It belongs to the people. And because of that, there's no copyright on the law. It isn't private property. It's available for everybody. And if you have to charge $500 to read the law, then all of a sudden it becomes a poll tax on access to justice.
There is an expense attached to developing and codifying these standards. If we take the revenue away from those who do this work, then what happens?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is that the nonprofits that develop these standards have a lot of different revenue streams. They do conferences, they do certification, they develop standards that aren't law. In fact, the vast majority of their standards are not. And so maybe they need to adjust their business model, particularly given the fact that they are a nonprofit public charity. Answer number two is that government has shirked its responsibilities. It said, gee, we can just incorporate these privately developed standards into law and we won't have to pay anything. And the only people that get screwed up by this are the citizens that need to read the law.
Well, I mean, King Solomon, I ain't, but it seems to me that there's a pretty obvious solution to all of this. And that is for the government to pay a fixed fee to any of these third-party organizations for providing the standards that the government goes on to adopt.
That's maybe one way to do it, but there's a couple things to look at. First of all, these organizations that develop the standards, they're getting the gold seal of approval from the United States government, and that's worth a lot to them. It means that they can sell training and certification and all sorts of things, and so I think they have a public obligation. But there are other solutions, such as calling them to the table and saying, look, if we're going to incorporate your stuff by reference into law, maybe they have a public obligation to share a little bit more. I know a member of Congress that was investigating hazmat during the BP oil spill wanted to read a standard having to do with pipeline safety and was told that it would cost $1,500 for him to read that.
All right. So as a champion of disclosure and the public's right to know, you are doing what to make sure that we have access to these standards?
There was a guy named Peter Veck in Texas in about the year 2000, decided that the Texas building code should be available. So he went and bought the model building code, then he put it on the internet, and it went to court, and it went up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit said, well, you know, maybe that model building code had copyright when it was a model building code, but once it is incorporated by law into the building code of Texas, it has no copyright, and therefore Peter Veck is allowed to post those. The Fifth Circuit decision was specifically about the Texas Building Code. The Code of Federal Regulations is different. The Fifth Circuit did not look at federal law. We believe the Veck decision does, in fact, apply to public safety standards incorporated into the Code of Federal Regulations, which is why we have picked 73 of these and intend to publish them on the net.
So you're saying I'm publishing these, come and get me.
No, I'm not saying come and get me. I'm saying I have the right to publish these. Please leave me alone. And so we sent notice to all these nonprofits and let them know that we've picked 73 of the standards and intend to publish them on the net. And we hope they just leave us alone like they do with the building codes.
But if you are sued and you fight back under VEC that you have the absolute right to publish what is incorporated in public law, then this issue at long last will be clarified. It's a win-win for you unless you, lose-lose.
Oh, I mean, we believe the law is on our side. We hope we don't litigate, but if we do litigate, the hope is that it will clarify this issue of the law must be available to everybody. It goes all the way back to the founding of the United States and the Constitutional Convention and very key Supreme Court decisions like Wheaton v. Peters in 1824 that said that there is no copyright in the law. So we think we'll win, and there is a risk that we do this, and as a result, the law costs money forever. But we don't think that'll happen.
Carl, many thanks.
Thank you.
Carl Malamud is president of Public Resource. That's public.resource.org. Coming up, American schools are failing or not failing. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Hey, tell me if you've heard this one before. Schools are failing. It's a national systemic epidemic of underfunding, sclerotic bureaucracy, inadequate teachers, overcrowding, and low morale. Add it all up, and what you get is sinking test scores, rising dropout rates, and students who are falling behind their peers internationally. How conventional is that wisdom? Well, Paul Fahre, a Washington Post reporter who wrote a recent essay in the American Journalism Review, says that the phrase failing schools was used 544 times in news articles in just 1 month this year. 20 years ago, it was cited in less than a dozen over the same period. So the press likes the term, says Fahre, but are schools failing? Before we begin, two disclosures. Paul and I are close friends, and Paul is extremely closely connected to the teaching industry.
My wife is a lifelong school teacher. I'll go one further. My mother was a lifelong school teacher.
Okay, so it's established you are just a shill for the teachers' unions. But the other thing is, you're obviously wrong, Paul, because I have been reading Why Johnny Can't Read in Time magazine, like every 10 years, for literally my entire life. Haven't I?
Yes, you have. And it goes back further than your entire life. You could probably go back to the founding of the Republic and even before then to find concerns expressed in prominent publications about the inadequacy of American education. I'll give you one example. Around the turn of the century, this would be the 19th century, there was widespread concern that the schools were not turning out enough workers to fill the highly technical jobs that were being created in mills and foundries and factories. Businessmen of the day were finding that workers were just not adequately educated and up to the task. Flash forward, you can take your pick. The Soviet Union is going to beat our brains out. They got Sputnik. We don't have enough math and science majors. Life magazine did a wonderful photo essay right after the launch of Sputnik comparing a Russian teenager and his heavy academic load versus a Chicago teenager and his carefree lifestyle. And of course, the headline was Crisis in Education.
So what you said was, all right, let's actually look at the data. And you concluded that American education actually is doing pretty well.
Yes, it depends where you look. That isn't to say all schools are perfect, all teachers are perfect, all education is perfect. It's far from it. There's a lot of inequity. But on the whole, on average, yes, we're getting better. More people going to college, more people graduating college, higher SAT scores, higher scores on international tests, lower dropout rates. You know, you can't look at the trend lines and say this is a crisis that's getting deeper and deeper. In fact, it's going the other way. We are a lot better than you would otherwise suspect from looking at the media day in and day out.
So you point out in your American Journalism Review piece that Americans, when polled, find their own schools to be just fine. But when asked to rate the performance of schools in general, they assess failing grades. What's that all about?
Yes, that's truly the media effect here. If you ask a parent at your local school how he feels about this local school, for the most part, they'll say, we like it. We know the teachers. We know the principal. We see our kid come home. We see their assignments. We're pretty happy with our local schools. If you then go to the general public and ask the general public about how they feel about schools, well, wait a second. That's a different story. Schools are in crisis. It's an opinion informed by only media accounts. There's no direct experience. There are tens of thousands of schools in America. Are they all failing? It just doesn't wash.
You understand that some students are leaving school unprepared in even, you know, the most rudimentary education.
That is correct. Who are those children? Where are those children? That's the real issue. And why are those children inadequately prepared? Part of the reason we get very excited and depressed about this at the same time is because we know more about this. We know about the achievement gap. No Child Left Behind, if it has done one thing, is to have exposed the differences between poor kids and rich kids, Black kids and white kids, Hispanic kids and Asian American kids. In part, let's recognize that certain schools are not as good as other schools, but let's also recognize who those children are. Those children tend to be poor, from families that are broken up, that are abused, that might be chronically ill, that have learning deficits, that have eyesight, hearing, mental illness that is unaddressed. The poverty rate among children in America today is at 22%. That means more than one in five children lives in poverty. That's going to lead to certain outcomes educationally. People don't really want to hear that because that implicates the real inequities of this society.
What fundamental mistake are the media making in just taking for granted the notion of systemic failure?
The idea that schools are failing is actually a phrase that is now locked into the public discourse by the passage and enactment of No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind sets up a whole high-stakes testing regime and holds schools to various standards, one of which enables politicians, school boards, etc., to declare schools failing. But the phrase has been made generic, and the term is, importantly, politicized. Politicians run on the basis of fixing the failing schools. No politician ever will say, you know, the schools in my district are doing just fine. The teachers are great. The kids are happy. Let's just leave it alone and let it go on. No, you have to be Democrat or Republican involved in fixing education.
I'm curious about the psychology of this. Is it just that as journalists, we are always ready to embrace reform, and that by framing educational policy as reform, you almost dictate that the press is going to be all in?
I don't think there is any conspiracy to this. The press isn't invested in the reform movement. They are simply covering the people who have adopted the reform movement as the prescription for what ails our schools. Reform feeds into the press bias toward conflict. Somebody wants to change something. The press likes that.
Now, there is one place in your piece where you find fault with the public schools, and that has to do literally with access to the classrooms for people like you.
One of the basic problems here is that reporters can't actually get in to see what goes on in the classroom. You don't get to talk to the teachers. You end up talking to the people way above the teachers, the administrators, the flacks for the school system. That's not a real good way to do reporting. One of the reactions I've gotten from this story is from a lot of teachers saying, thank you for putting into print the things I've not been able to say to my local reporter because they won't let me say those things. The school districts are fearful that will expose something they don't want to see. So they shut us out.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Bob. I really enjoyed it.
Paul Fahrey is reporter for The Washington Post and senior contributing writer for the American Journalism Review. This week, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court ruled that an anti-hacking statute called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act could not be used to prosecute a man named David Nosal, who was accused of convincing some former colleagues to give him access to a database at his old job. Observers had opined that this decision could have ramifications in the case of suspected WikiLeaker Bradley Manning, who is also charged, at least in part, with violating the CFAA. At stake is the legal definition of what constitutes a hacker. In a piece that originally ran last fall, OTM producer Alex Goldman says that the cultural definition of the term hacker has undergone a stunning transformation since it first entered the lexicon in the late 1950s.
It seems like over the past couple of years, we are constantly hearing stories about high-profile hacks.
A British tabloid is being accused tonight of going much too far to get a story. Mark Phillips reports the newspaper hacked into the phone messages of a missing 13-year-old girl.
Guessing voicemail passwords? Not really a hack.
Supporters of the whistleblowing website and its controversial founder, Julian Assange, are targeting government and private websites that have taken action against WikiLeaks.
Denial of service attack on a website? Not a hack either.
A Tennessee college student has been indicted for allegedly hacking into the private email account of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin.
That college student made an educated guess at Palin's password. Sorry, not a hack. So then what is hacking? Let's trace the term back about five decades to a student club at MIT called the Tech Model Railroad Club. Stephen Levy, author of Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution.
The people who were working underneath the table, where on top of the table there was a very elaborate train layout, called themselves hackers because they hacked away this very complicated system that ran the trains in a very sophisticated manner. Hacking meant fiddling around with technology in sort of an irreverent and makeshift way.
Previously, MIT students had used the word hack as slang for prank. Combining its roots in pranking and its use by the Tech Model Railroad Club pretty much encompasses what it means today. This original set of hackers happened to take the first undergraduate computing course at MIT, exploring these enormous, expensive, new toys literally around the clock. From this culture, a set of moral imperatives which Levy has dubbed the hacker ethic began to emerge.
Things that people thought that you couldn't and shouldn't do on computer, those are the things the hackers wanted to do. Hackers basically believe that all information should be free, that anything that keeps you away from information should be surmounted.
As university computers began to connect to one another in the late 60s, so did the hacker. In 1975, a glossary of hacker terms was created called the Jargon File, proliferating hacker ideas and ideals. The term hacker expanded to include those who created open-source software, specifically designed to be shared and improved upon. Hackers began to explore other people's computers too, sometimes with questionable legality. By 1983, with the release of the blockbuster movie War Games,
shall we play a game?
Popular culture had already hammered out a stereotypical notion of what a hacker is. Smart, alienated, prone to illegal activity, and borderline autistic.
Wow, where'd you get this?
I was trying to break into Protovision. I wanted to see the program for their new games.
Hey, wait, Tim, I'm not through yet.
Remember you told me to tell you when you were acting rudely and insensitively? Remember that? You're doing it right now.
War Games, about a teenager who hacks into a military supercomputer, triggering a nuclear panic, forever tainted the word hacker, even though it's never actually uttered in the film. 2 months after the release of the movie, the FBI raided a group of teenage hackers called the 414s. Named for their Milwaukee area code, the 414s broke into a number of high-profile computer systems. Comparisons to War Games were immediate, prompting media coverage like this from CBS's Nightwatch.
The fact came a little too close to fiction in Milwaukee recently. Some whiz kids actually managed to dial their way into a computer at a nuclear weapons lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico. The lab says no classified information was compromised, but the question remains, could it really happen?
17-year-old Neil Patrick self-appointed spokesman for the 414s, testified before Congress in September of 1983 about computer security concerns. Congressman Dan Glickman opened the proceedings by saying, quote, "We're going to show about 4 minutes from the movie War Games, which I think outlines the problem fairly clearly." Within months, a flurry of legislation was introduced specifically targeting this kind of intrusion, and in the public eye, the word hacker became synonymous with criminal. NYU assistant professor Gabriella Coleman says that by the late 80s, hackers started to try to reclaim the word.
Some hackers came up with the term cracker, which was meant to differentiate what a hacker means from a cracker, which is someone who breaks into a system maliciously or with malicious intent or engages in destruction or theft.
The hacker community wanted the media to make a distinction between hackers and crackers, but the distinction never stuck. Partly because every self-respecting hacker has a different definition of the term. For instance, security-conscious hackers will say,
"You know, those free and open-source software developers, those are not hackers, because they're just building and tinkering." I've also heard among free and open-source software hackers who consider any form of transgressive hacking as that which doesn't qualify under the rubric of hacking, because hacking is only constructive. And so there are many times where people will point fingers and say, that's not really part of the hacking community.
In the hacker community, hacker has always been something of an honorific, a title that cannot be self-proclaimed, only bestowed. If you call yourself a hacker, chances are you're not. Anonymous, the notorious collective of hacktivists implicated in some recent attacks, definitely contains some old-school hackers. But the majority use a pre-existing program called the Low Orbit Ion Cannon to take down websites. The hacker community derisively calls these techno-opportunists script kiddies.
Script kiddie is such a great term to designate those participants, actors who may be engaging in something that looks like hacking, but doing so in the most kind of unthoughtful, unintelligent way, where you're just kind of using a tool to, let's just say, break into a system. It's sort of like a hacker wannabe without the technical skills.
In fact, in recent years, the word hack has been somewhat rehabilitated. Take, for example, Danny O'Brien, the technology journalist who works for the Committee to Protect Journalists. In 2004, he coined the phrase life hacks to describe applying the efficiency and creativity of hacking to things like making tea or setting your alarm clock.
I've been tracking how a lot of geeks seem to be incredibly productive. They all have these little sort of systems for organizing themselves. And so it seemed very sensible to call this life hacks because these were geeky people, they were hackers, and they were sort of applying this semi-scientific, semi-engineering approach to things like, you know, getting out of bed on time, which is something I find impossible.
Which is not to say that the hacker community necessarily appreciated it.
I have a small twinge of guilt because as soon as I coined this term life hacks, it became part of a pattern of the word hacks being over-applied or applied in ways that some people who use it don't necessarily agree with, right? As soon as people started thinking of these things as life hacks, people would post things going, "Oh, I found a new way of tying my shoelaces. I'm hacking my shoes right now."
When you go to Silicon Valley and you talk to startup people, they all talk about, "We want to hire hackers for our company."
Stephen Levy suggests that hack may be regaining its original meaning.
Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says, "We want this to be a hacker company." You go to Facebook headquarters, there's big signs saying hack. And Facebook isn't breaking into other people's computers. They're talking about coming up with really good products, and those are the kinds of people they want.
I think we already have a more nuanced idea of the word hack compared to this very sort of one or the other idea that we had in the 80s.
Danny O'Brien says it no longer summons up mad scientists or hapless teens.
The word hacker internally in the subculture is incredibly subtle, and I do think that subtlety is gradually beginning to bleed into its use in the mainstream media, too.
But subtlety is not a media strong point. So what does this debate over the word leave us with? A mysterious set of evolving skills and shifting ethics, an annoying feeling of uncertainty, just like how many old media types feel about new media. But the media have to do a better job of distinguishing among actors in this ongoing drama. Otherwise, the only unambiguous hacks will be the reporters themselves. Well, you know what I mean. For On the Media, I'm Alex Goldman.
To learn more about the Ninth Circuit decision on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, check out an explainer on our blog at onthemedia.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.